have my Bible again today. This is a Bible study, so maybe we'll have to change the name once or twice. Going through the course of church history, I don't have any scriptures. I mean, I could add in some scriptures and throw in a couple of points. And basically, we call that proof texting, where you kind of you throw in a scripture just to kind of make to prove your point, but it really wasn't your point. And because I'm going through in the transition historically of church history, not so much doctrine as we were addressing in early church history, where I could argue in that sense on the Passover versus Easter or other issues, it would be as we come into the time of the Protestant Reformation, we would have to go through a whole series of studies if I began to argue predestination and other things that became part of the Protestant doctrines. And so I'm going through more historically, and some of the doctrinal subjects are issues I'll address in sermons specifically. But I want to start today with the Waldenses, more commonly known sometimes as the Waldensians, but when you look them up historically, you see them as the Waldenses as well. And they are a group of people starting in the late 1100s, and they continued to about the 1500s. In fact, there are even some people still use that name to this day, but they're far removed, in that sense, from those that we see historically. And I would like to read you a little bit of information on the Waldenses, starting from Blunt's dictionary, and this is always amazement to me. If you want to find something about the Church of God, you have to look up a book that's called Sects, Heresies, and Schools of Thought. Just not the mainline people, I don't suppose. But under Waldenses, it says, one of the various religious bodies that rose up in the 12th century against the dominant power of the clergy. The Waldenses are the most celebrated, not only on account of the purity of their moral character, but because their descendants still linger in the valleys of the Western Alps. And so there is, at least by name, descendants that exist even yet today. They claim for themselves a high antiquity. We're talking now in parts of France in this. They claim for themselves a high antiquity. It's even been maintained that their church was founded by the Apostle Paul. Isn't that amazing? Somebody actually claimed to go back to the Apostle Paul and claim not to be Catholic. That they alone have preserved primitive faith. Strange as well that someone should say that they alone were the ones who had maintained this faith. And discipline through the corruptions of the dark and the Middle Ages to the present time. Another account of their origin is when Constantine established and endowed the church. When was that? When did Constantine establish and endow the church? 325, Council of Nicaea. Under Sylvester, the Bishop of Rome, the inhabitants of these valleys kept themselves aloof from the rest of the Latin communion. Again, we're talking about a time when Roman Christianity became the law of the land. The Waldenses claim to have separated themselves and refused to be part of that communion, and that they remained unknown in their obscure valleys and mountain passes until attention was drawn to them in the 12th century by the spread of heresy in France and northern Italy. Why would attention have been drawn to them, even possibly off to the side of where heretical, and heretical by Catholic definition, understand, off to the side of other religious groups of the day, protesters in a sense, early protesters against the Catholic Church? What would have happened in the 12th century that would have caused them to be discovered? Anybody? Anybody want to take a gander from what we've covered as what was happening in France in the 12th century? Where did the Crusades start, remember? The Crusades started in France. They didn't start in the Middle East. And so what we have is we have this major push against heresy, as it was called, and Crusaders going down and slaughtering people and looking for anyone that was in disagreement with the Catholic faith. And in the course of that, the Waldenses as well became exposed and began to receive persecution as well in that same period of time. From the Britannica, 11th edition, says the name Waldenses was given to the members of the heretical Christian sect which arose in the south of France about 1170. The history of the sect in the Middle Ages is obscure. What does sect mean? Sect means, it means group, but it means opinion. It's like the sect of the Pharisees, the opinion of the Pharisees. The same term could be used for the sect of the United Church of God. Now, I don't know that I would like that, because it has a connotation with it, but that's how it's used. It says the earliest accounts of them come from those who were concerned in their suppression and were therefore eager to lay upon each of them the worst enormities that could be attributed. I've mentioned that before. Many of the accounts that we have are accounts of the oppressors, and the oppressors want to make them look as evil as possible. And so the accounts many times will attribute things that have no basis whatsoever. In later times, the apologists of each sect reversed the process and cleared that which they were interested in at the expense of others. In other words, then the defenders of these groups came along later and defended them to the point that it really wasn't an honest portrayal because they defended at the expense of everyone else. In other words, people selfishly promote their own cause and selfishly persecute others. And it works both ways. Another, Mr. Blackwell, Dean Blackwell, did his thesis when he was going through some graduate work at college. And he wrote a handbook of church history, and he compiled a number of sources. And one of the books that I have now in my library is Jones' Church History. And I have it because of his recommendation some years ago, and it is an excellent record because it gives reference to some things that other histories do not. But in Jones' Church History, or one of Jones' books, The History of the Churches of the Piedmont, it says that he mentions the church is recorded, the Waldenses is called the Church of God. And it's observed that it is a people called the Waldenses. And so there's historical record as well that those people were also recognized as in part being called as the Church of God. Many of the Waldenses' beliefs were biblically correct, but again, we see God's people as having likely been among them, but we don't see the Waldenses as a body, as the true church. Now, at this point in time, any opposition, anyone in opposition to the Catholic Church was excommunicated and declared anathema from Christ. And I copied some material out of Fox's Book of Martyrs. That's kind of what you read at lunch, you know, when you're having a little sandwich, taking a break. You read Fox's Book of Martyrs for some color. It says the proceedings of Waldo, Peter Waldo is sometimes attributed as being, in a sense, the founder of the Waldenses, that they're named after him. The proceedings of Waldo and the Reformed occasioned the first risk of the Inquisitors, or the Inquisition. Pope Innocent III authorized certain monks as Inquisitors to inquire for and deliver over the Reformed to the secular power. Same thing the Jews did. They turned Christ over to the Romans. And so here we have them turning over those to the secular power of the day. The process was short, as an accusation was deemed adequate to guilt, and a candid trial was never granted to the accused. The Pope, finding that these cruel means had not the intended effect, sent several learned monks to preach among the Waldenses and to endeavor to argue them out of their opinions. Among these monks was one Dominique. What order did Dominique institute? The Dominicans. What did the Dominicans do? What was their purpose? Inquisition. When you see these cute little ads for the Dominicans and all the good things they do, I assume they do good things. But the history of the Dominicans is that they were repeatedly used in the Inquisition, along with the Franciscans. using the Inquisition, who appeared extremely zealous in the cause appropriated. This Dominique instituted an order which from him was called the Order of the Dominican Friars, and the members of this order have ever since been the principal inquisitors in the various inquisitions in the world. The power of the inquisitors was unlimited. They proceeded against whom they pleased without any consideration of age, sex, or rank. Let the accusers be ever so infamous, the accusation was deemed valid. And even anonymous information sent by letter was thought sufficient evidence. To be rich was a crime equal to heresy. Therefore, many who had money were accused of heresy or being favorers of heretics, and that they might be obliged to pay for their opinions. Church of God's pretty safe, by and large, on that basis. The dearest friends or nearest kindred could not, without danger, serve anyone who was imprisoned on account of religion. To convey to those who were confined a little straw or to give them a cup of water was called favoring the heretics, and they were prosecuted accordingly. No lawyer dared to plead for his own brother, and their malice even extended beyond the grave. Hence the bones of many were dug up and burnt as examples to the living. If a man on his deathbed was accused of being a follower of Waldo, his estates were confiscated, and the heir to them defrauded of his inheritance, and some were sent to the Holy Land. Why were they sent to the Holy Land? Well, you went on a crusade to pay for your sins against the church and prove your fidelity, prove your allegiance. And so you joined a crusade to prove that you were not a heretic. While the Dominicans took possession of their houses and properties, and when the owners returned, would often pretend not to know them. These persecutions were continued for several centuries under different popes and other great dignitaries of the Catholic Church. And so Fox's, like say, Book of Martyrs, kind of light reading. It's terrible, gruesome stuff at some of the accounts of the tortures and the things that took place. During this period of time, the Crusaders did gain control of Jerusalem by the 1200s, I mean by the early moments of the Waldenses, but by the 1200s, the Arabs took it back. And how long did the Arabs keep control of Jerusalem? Well, over 400 years, 1917. It was the Ottoman Empire, the collapse of the Ottoman Empire before the control of Jerusalem was taken back. It's in some of our own personal lifetimes. Conversion of Peter Waldo is of interest here. Kamba has a book, The History of the Waldenses in Italy. He says, one day while in the company of some of the leading citizens, again, Eastern France here, Lyon, one of Waldo's friends fell lifeless at his side. Terrified by the event, he said to himself, if death had stricken me, what would have become of my soul? Waldo, a Catholic, asked the theologian, what is the perfect way? Ah, answered the theologian, here is Christ's precept. If you will be perfect, go sell what you have and give it to the poor, and then you shall have treasure in heaven. Come and take up your cross and follow me. What famous person, what famous Catholic had somebody that was killed next to him and survived and decided to then become a priest? Just guess a wild name. You'll hit it maybe. Martin Luther. When we go through some of it, you'll find some of the same circumstance. He distributed most of his money to his family and to the poor, spent the remainder of his money on translating portions of the Bible into the French vernacular. What happens when you translate the Bible into the French vernacular back then? You're dead. You're a dead man. That wasn't allowable. People weren't supposed to read the Bible. You were supposed to hear the Bible taught by the priest, but if you were to read it or even own a copy of it without permission, it was your life. He took the office of apostle, set out to preach the gospel and the things he had committed to memory. There was an enormous religious resurgence in the area, and a major work was done in that area at that time. Britannica, 11th edition, some further information. It says, Waldo adopted a life of poverty so that he would be free to preach, but with this difference that the Waldenses preach the doctrine of Christ, while the Franciscans preached the person of Christ. That's an interesting distinction, if you remember the distinction Mr. Armstrong used to make in terms of the gospel. He said, the person of Christ has been preached, but the gospel has not. And it says that Waldo here preached the doctrine of Christ to the Waldenses. The Franciscans preached the person of Christ. I mean, this is Britannica now. This isn't, you know, some polemic. Waldo reformed teaching while Francis kindled love. Hence, the one awakened antagonism while the other escaped. One preached love, and that was acceptable. One preached to reform and to change and to flee sin, and that was unacceptable. Waldo had a translation of the New Testament made into the common French, and his preachers not only stirred up men to more holy lives, but explained the scriptures at their will. Such an interference with the ecclesiastical authorities led to difficulties. It must have been written by an Englishman, you know, very tongue-in-cheek here, led to difficulties. The earliest account given of the Waldensian opinion, their beliefs, is that of the Inquisitor Sacconi about 1250. He divides them into two classes. The first class hold that oaths are forbidden by the gospel. Capital punishment was not allowed in that group. And any layman may consecrate the sacrament of the altar, but the Roman Church is not the Church of Christ. And he says the other sect went so far as to say that the Roman Church was the scarlet woman of the apocalypse, whose precepts ought not to be obeyed, especially when appointing fast days. So there was very strong and direct opposition in that respect. There is record that the Waldenses kept the Sabbath, some of them. It's disputed in some records. One of the other accounts, let's see if I've left one out here. Let me read an account. How many of you have Duggar and Dodd's History of the True Church in here? There's one, two. Wow, those used to be common. That used to be just a real common book that they used it as a text even in AC at one point in time. Some comments from their record of church history. It says, poor as they are content to live separate from the rest of mankind. One thing is astonishing, that persons externally so savage and rude should have so much moral cultivation. They can all read and write. They're acquainted with French so far as is needful for the understanding of the Bible and the singing of the Psalms. You can scarcely find a boy among them who cannot give you an intelligible account of the faith which they profess. In this, indeed, they resemble the brethren of other valleys. They pay tribute with good conscience, and the obligation of this duty is particularly noted in the confession of their faith. If by any reason of civil war they're prevented from doing this, they carefully set apart the sum and at the first opportunity give it to the king's taxpayers. Now, wouldn't that be an interesting thing to see happen? Y2K crashes everything and taxes can't be collected. I'm not saying that'll happen. I'm being very tongue-in-cheek here. And then everybody, of course, just sets aside their own money so they can make sure they pay their taxes when things are reestablished. But that's the record that they had. They were very faithful to the civil law. They were obedient to the government, but they were, in that sense, faithful directly to God. William Jones, in his History of the Christian Church, says they kept the Sabbath day. A record in the church history here says, the Bishop of Cavaillon once obliged a teaching monk to enter into conference with the Waldenses that they might be convinced of their errors and the effusion of blood might be prevented because they were about to be slaughtered. This happened during a persecution in 1541, but the monk returned in confusion owing that he had never known in his whole life so much of the scripture as he had learned in those few days that he had held conference with them. The bishop, however, sent among them a number of doctors. One of them openly owned that he had understood more of the doctrine of salvation from the answers of little children in their catechism than by all the disputations that he had previously heard. The same author informs us further that Louis XII, importuned by the calumny of the informers, sent two respectable persons into the province to make inquiry. They reported that in visiting all of the parishes and temples, they found no images or Roman ceremonies but that they could not discover any marks of the crimes to which they were charged, that the Sabbath day was strictly observed, that they were baptized according to the rules of the primitive church, and instructed their children in the articles of the Christian faith and the commandments of God. Louis, having heard the report, declared with an oath, "They are better men than myself or my people." So there is record. Once you get into the Waldenses, you get into a time when there is some record of the Sabbath being kept. And as you get into about the 1400s and 1500s, there's very strong record at that point of the Sabbath being kept. Remember, when you see reference being made to the Sabbath, the Catholics do not call Sunday the Sabbath. It's the Protestants who call Sunday the Sabbath. And so in Catholic history as such, where Sabbath is referenced, generally speaking, you're going to be talking about a reference to Saturday, the seventh day. It was the Protestants who made that change where the Sabbath was now transferred to Sunday. Now, that doesn't mean they weren't keeping, it just means where they began to use that term. Another book called Persecutions and Atrocities of the, well, it's French, Vaudois, Vaudois. I took French 2 years and forgot everything I ever took. Says they observed the seventh day of the week according to the commandment, they immersed for believers baptism, and they kept the Passover once a year in the first month. So there are scattered, but you understand, the records were destroyed by the inquisitors, by the accusers, by the persecutors. They were burned, the heretics were burned with the books, and accusation was made. And so it's really hard to go back and sort little pieces of history out of areas that have been so destroyed. Fire was, at this point, the preferred method of killing heretics and destroying their literature. It was in this basic period of time that Dante wrote the Divine Comedy, and because fire was preferred for heretics, it was what he used in his portrayals in terms of how he portrayed hell, fire, and also some of what Dante colorfully portrayed became part of the church's portrayal in terms of hell as well. There was a connection there. Because so many of the manuscripts and books were being destroyed, memorization was the only guarantee of access to the scriptures. You know, we have had sometimes people felt that back in Sabbath school in the past that there was too much memory work, that it was a burden on the children, that this was, you know, not really. We've become such a mushy, soft, coddled society that we don't even understand. We just don't understand. Children then would memorize parts of the Bible so that if it was destroyed or confiscated, it could be reproduced. A school was formed in Switzerland for training ministers. All the students had to memorize Matthew, John, and all of the epistles of Paul. They also learned the Proverbs and many of the Psalms. Now, you have to understand, many people could not read or write, and few Bibles were available. And so, even in the text of Scripture, much of the Bible was transmitted orally at that time, back and forth for sharing. If you were going to share the Bible with someone, you would have to memorize parts of it, and then you couldn't copy it off like we would do today and give them a few sheets. The Waldenses produced a publication that was entitled The Herald of Truth in their day. On it was an insignia of a candlestick on a shield, and by that, a candlestick, and around it were seven stars, and a light shone on the fourth one at the top. And if you look at church eras, Thyatira would have been the era from our guess that would have fallen in that time. We don't know if that's a direct connection, if they understood their position or not, but it was curiosity. A Latin phrase on the shield read, "A light shines in the darkness." The Waldenses were very careful about who they selected for their ministry. It says, "Great care is exercised so as not to consecrate any to this office but true believers. In fact, the aspirants to this important charge were required to give proof of their humility and sincere desire to consecrate themselves to the work of the ministry. The pastors train their successors. We give them lessons, they say, in their discipline. We make them learn by heart the whole of Matthew and John and the canonical epistles and a good part of the writings of Solomon, David, and the prophets. And afterwards, if good testimony is borne to their character, they are admitted by the imposition of hands to the office of preaching. Now, it's interesting because you're looking at two different things when you're talking about their young people were required to memorize these things, and then you see an account that says it was those who were preparing for the ministry. They prepared young people for service in the ministry, who then would serve under older ministers and answer to them until they would serve fully on their own, it would appear at least. The right of consecrating them was vested in the pastors. Among other powers which God has given his servants, he has given them the power to choose pastors who may govern the people and to appoint elders to their offices according to the diversity of their employments and the unity of Christ, as the apostle proves in his epistle to Titus. This is record in reference to the Waldenses. Again, from Britannica. It says, their ministers were chosen from among laboring men who at the age of 25 might ask the body of ministers to be admitted as candidates. They had ministerial trainees in that sense. If their character was approved, they were taught. Now, it's interesting. First, they were already someone who had a job. And at the age of 25, if they were working and employed, and they wanted to be considered for the ministry, then their character was evaluated, and they were chosen to then be prepared to be trained. Now, I'm not saying that's scripture. I'm just saying that was what they did. That's not necessarily a bad approach. If their character was approved, they were taught during the winter months when work was slack for a space of 3 or 4 years. After that, they were sent for 2 years to serve as menial assistants at a nunnery for women. Now, that is a bad idea. Menial assistants at a nunnery for women. I'm not sure what, I guess they had to clean up and take care of the place or whatever. They had to prove, they had to really want to be ministers back then, you know. In our time, they sent you out as a ministerial trainee, and you still had to really want to be a minister. Then they were admitted to office by the imposition of hands of all ministers present. They went out to preach two by two, and the junior was bound absolutely to obey the senior. Their duties were to visit all within their district once a year, hear their confessions, advise and admonish them. So it's, to me, it's of great interest to go back and read some of the accounts of these people, especially as you get closer down to our time, because you begin to see things that are more recognizable. And there's an account I'll read to you as well today in, that I used, part of which I used in a sermon probably a year or two back. But I want to read it today in the course of the study because of the time it portrays. I want to look at the Reformation a little more directly and the Catholic Church in that time. From the 900s to about the 1500s, the papacy was very, very corrupt. Some of the popes committed adultery, incest, and even rape. Others committed murder and violent acts. Again, if you have, how many have Haley's Bible Handbook? Okay, that's much more common. There's a section there under church history which documents much of what took place. Haley's, because it's condensed. The majority of the bishops at this time purchased their offices. They bought their office. Some of them were only children. It also became the church policy to keep the common people uneducated. And I've mentioned that in other respect. But I want to read you from Halley's Bible. Hey, this man that wrote this handbook. He has a section, you can look this up, it's page 783 in his handbook. He says, Hildebrand, now we're starting back in about the year 1000 or so, and he's going to go through and he's going to go all the way up into the mid-1800s, about 1854. So we're not talking about something that happened just clear back, you know, 1,000 years ago. We're talking about things that are within 150 years that he's recording. Hildebrand ordered Bohemians not to read the Bible. Innocent III forbade the people reading the Bible in their own language. Gregory the Ninth forbade laymen possessing the Bible and he suppressed translations. Translations among the Albigenses and the Waldenses were burned and people burned for having them. Paul the Fourth prohibited the possession of translations without permission of the Inquisition. The Jesuits induced Clement the Eleventh, we're up to the 1700s here, to condemn the reading of the Bible to the laity. Leo the XII, Pius the VIII, and Gregory the VI, and Pius the IX, we're up to 1854 now, as he follows through, all condemned Bible societies. In Catholic countries, the Bible is an unknown book. And it's not Catholic alone. Many people who claim to be religious are superficially so. But you can claim to be Catholic, and you can be voodoo Catholic. You could be a Indian animist Catholic. You can be any kind you want, because that's what happened. They took the religion of the people and combined it with the customs of the day in terms of religion, and they put them together in a package. And that's what they did in 300 and 500 and 1,000. They do it today. I'm just saying it's simply the system that is in place. Indulgences and penance were instituted during this time. And what that means is if you did good things and made sacrifices, that reduced your time, your punishment in purgatory. You went to purgatory, but you went to hell if you were lost. This is, as I understand, without having had extensive studies, you went to purgatory if you were just a bad boy. And in purgatory, you got cleaned up a little bit over time, and then you could go eventually to heaven. So, in the most generic sense, by doing indulgences and making penance, you could reduce your time in the bad boy part of the program and expedite your entrance into heaven. Originally, the way you did that is you'd go on a crusade. You'd go fight somebody, kill a few people, slaughter a few women, children, and then that got you out of trouble for being a bad boy. Now, you could do the same thing by giving a large offering to the church. That was considered a very honorable, sacrificial thing to do. You give a large offering, and that was considered kind of a penance or what became to be indulgence. And finally, you could just buy your way out of purgatory with a sum of money, you know. You could buy so many years for so many dollars. You could just, you know, nobody knew exactly how many years you were going to go there, but just to be safe, you know, you could kind of pick up what you thought you might need. Today, you can still pay for a mass to be said for the dead, for related in various ways, much the same reason. It's also considered favorable to go on pilgrimages. If you go to France or places where there have been miracles reported and you go on a pilgrimage, that's also considered something good on your record in that respect. Leo X in the 1500s granted indulgences on the broadest scale that they had been known yet. He became an archbishop at the age of 8. He was a cardinal by the age of 13. He later appointed a cardinal who was 7 years old. These were the conditions that led to the Reformation. You know, this is what happened and what made this open rebellion such, so necessary, it seemed, on the part of those who did. Attempts were being made through this time to reform the Catholic Church. They were attempts from within. There's a number of individuals who predated Martin Luther. The Protestant Reformation is counted from Martin Luther. But there were individuals inside the Catholic Church who didn't stay there long that were trying to reform the system, but simply it hadn't taken hold as a body. John Wycliffe was in the 1300s, one of the earliest individuals to try to institute reforms. He was the first to translate the Bible into English. He taught that the Ten Commandments were to be kept, although they were worshiping on Sunday. His followers were called Lollards, and they existed in Germany as well. And some of his followers were the Waldenses as well. We begin to see now groups moving into England. Sabbath keepers and people fleeing religious persecution begin to move into England, because there were times in England where there was peace and safety there. John Huss, in the late 13, early 1400s, tried to make changes in the Catholic Church. He worked in Czechoslovakia and began to keep the Sabbath there, the Seventh-day Sabbath. Do you know there really was a place called Transylvania? Sabbath keepers were in Transylvania. Romania today used to be Transylvania. John Huss laid a foundation for Sabbath keepers to begin to observe Sabbath and keep it, and we have records from his time forward that are fairly consistent. He was burned at the stake. The emperor gave him a safe conduct pass to come and answer some of the charges against him. He had a safe conduct pass, a promise of protection by the emperor, and then he was excommunicated by the Catholic Church, and they burned him at the stake. I guess they burned his pass, too. They kind of took it back. The reason you could do that, you didn't have to keep your word to a heretic. He was a heretic. If he was considered a heretic, then you had no obligation to him, any further obligation at all. The logic, I don't know if I mentioned this, what was the logic of killing a heretic after he recanted? If you had a heretic, again, in the sense that's used historically, you were a heretic to the Catholic Church, you did not accept their dominion or their doctrine, and so you're accused, you're brought in the Inquisition to the Dominicans, and you say, oh, I'm sorry, you know, I under torture, you know, they got you all stretched out, and they're treating you kind of meanly. And you say, look, I'm sorry, I won't do that. I promise to go to church. I'll be a good Catholic. I'll do anything you say. Just let me go back. And then after you do that, they kill you. Now, why? All right. Peter says to save your soul. You see, that prevented you from making that same mistake again. And if you just were a bad boy, you got to go to purgatory, and eventually, you know, a few million years, I don't know what it took, you work your way out of that place. But if your soul was lost, you go to hell, and you're lost forever. There's no future. So if they could get you to recant and then kill you, they actually considered they were doing you a favor. Now, isn't it interesting about this? Some would kill you and consider they're doing God a favor. And they really did. And, you know, does this mean people weren't sincere? Let's give the credit for somebody who was sincere. But that's like running a yield sign. You know, it's your right away, but you get killed anyway because somebody rolls through. I mean, it doesn't matter if you're dead right. That doesn't help. Martin Luther was originally a Catholic priest. We're now down to the late 1400s, early 1500s. He's thought by many Protestants to be the third greatest man who lived in modern times. Christ first, Paul second, and Martin Luther is number three. One time he and his companions were struck by lightning. He survived and decided to be a priest. Figured if he could put up with lightning, might as well be a priest. He was ready. He was well educated. He had a doctorate in theology. Also was an accomplished musician. We have sung a number of his songs over the years at the feast or in church. Very beautiful music. He was a fine musician. He translated the Bible into German. He could read both the Greek and the Hebrew and was a scholar. Very, very well educated man. His translation is to German as the King James Version is to English. It is the fundamental German translation that is used to this day. Though he disagreed with the Catholic Church on various issues, obviously quite a few, he tracked his 95 theses to the door in Wittenberg in 1517. He was more nearly Catholic than any other reformer. And to this day, the Lutheran Church is the least in distance from the Catholic Church, and what has happened by some has not reunited, but come back to agreement on some basic issues. Indulgences were a big issue in the time of Martin Luther. Luther was supported by some of the nobility in the northern part of Germany of that day. He acknowledged that the Catholic Church was the true Church of God, and he believed that it needed to be reformed. He did not think that he was establishing a new religion. That was not his purpose. And he began, again, what we call now the Protestant Reformation. Protestant, by definition, refers to protest against the Catholic Church. That's the definition. The Reformation was an attempt to reform the false doctrines of the day. Today, Protestant is simply used as non-Catholic. It's used in a very broad sense. In other words, if we're not Catholic, we are considered in many circles then to be Protestant. His major doctrine was that man is saved by grace alone and that works have no bearing at all. And that was Martin Luther's contribution to the system. This was a reaction to the fact that you could buy salvation in the Catholic Church by doctrine. The problem is, when man is saved by grace alone and works have no bearing at all, in that same package, the law is done away. Not just explained away, done away. Cannot apply, because works do not impact salvation. Since the book of James says that man is justified by works, Luther concluded that it wasn't an inspired book, and he called it an epistle of straw, and did not recognize it as part of the canon. He also rejected 1st, 2nd, and 3rd John and Revelation as not inspired. In Switzerland, John Calvin wasn't the type of person you'd want to be raised by, necessarily. He was in the 1500s. He made his religion the state religion. He was extremely harsh and severe, very ascetic, and out of John Calvin came hellfire preaching. He believed that you kind of scared people to salvation by dangling them over the fires of hell. And so it was out of Calvinism. And some of his doctrine has been retained in much Protestant religion today. Doctrines like man is totally depraved from birth. Man is unconditionally predestined to be saved or lost. Redemption, then, is only granted to the elect. You see, some people believe in the Protestant body of the church that the church's job is simply to go out and find those people who are predestined to be saved. That's the missionary effort. They're predestined to be saved, therefore God will make provision for them to hear the word, but you have to reach them with it. And so that there's kind of a partnership then that ensues. They teach, in that sense, and I don't say everyone teaches, I'm saying part of the doctrines from Calvin have been retained down into Protestantism today. They taught that God's grace is irresistible. If a person is predestined to be saved, he will respond to the call of the church. It's irresistible. And that once a person is saved, he is always saved. You cannot fall from grace. And that's kind of built into that text. John Knox, during the 1500s, established a Calvinist movement in Scotland, and it became the Presbyterian Church, which is a much milder form of Calvinism. I grew up Presbyterian, and I've always described the Presbyterian background that I had is you could believe anything you want and be a Presbyterian. I mean, it's very middle of the road, kind of a mainstream, very tolerant type of religion. Within 30 years after Martin Luther tacked those theses on the door in Wittenberg in 1517, within 30 years, Protestantism swept completely across Europe. I mean, it's like taking a balloon that's full of air and hitting it with a needle. I mean, it was ripe, and all of this changed. And then what happened then was whole nations were converting to Protestant religion, and particular brands of Protestant religion that were set up under an individual of that day. And so a period of war then ensued, which lasted over about 100 years, as the Catholics began to fight with the Protestants, and finally lines were kind of drawn, and those nations that were almost entirely Protestant were left on their side of the line, and the effort was then made to simply stamp out. Ooh, sorry about that. That was a Freudian slip. Stamp there, hit the microphone. An effort was then made just to stamp out the minority groups that existed on either side. The Protestants weren't very tolerant of the Catholics. Frankly, the Catholics weren't very tolerant of the Protestants, and you had to be on the right side of the line to survive, and the right religion. And that's, quite frankly, the way it was in many respects in this country when we started, when we were founded. You could keep the Sabbath in Rhode Island, but you might not do very well in Pennsylvania. So you kind of had to be, the religion of the day was invested in the people who settled, and they enforced their religion in many respects. True freedom of religion is something that developed in this country in reality, as compared to something that was always there. The Anabaptists. Their name comes from the practice that they rebaptized repentant Christians. If you were 30 years old and you began to believe as they did, you had to be rebaptized because they didn't consider your other baptism to be valid. Let me see. I from J. N. Andrews' History of the Sabbath. He says the ancient Sabbath was retained and observed by a portion of the Anabaptists. Dr. Francis White, one of the public officials appointed by the government of England to write against the Sabbath argument that came up in the 13 to 1500s, says, they which maintain the Saturday Sabbath to be enforced comply with some Anabaptists. As I said, from about the 1300s to the 1500s on, the Sabbath becomes visible, and there are various records that begin to surface now showing where the Sabbath was kept and what some of the doctrinal beliefs of those people were. Some of the offshoots, some of the groups that came out of the Anabaptists were the Amish, the Mennonites, and the Hutterites. A book, Anabaptism, Non-Catholic Christians from 1525 to 1618 in Switzerland, Austria, Monrovia, and South and Central Germany, long title. Says the Anabaptists in this area of Germany met on Wednesday and Saturday in 1539. They not only rejected the traditional feast days as Catholic inventions, but also advanced strange views concerning Sunday. They maintained that there was no difference between Sunday and any other day of the week. That was a rather strange view in that day. They condemned oaths and also military service. Now, one of the best records that has come up historically was printed in the Jewish Quarterly Review in July of 1890. And it refers to a group of Sabbath keepers in Eastern Europe in the 1500s. They were Anabaptists by historical record. They were called the Molokani or the Sabotniki. They were generally Sabbatarians. It was predominantly a Sabbatarian group. And some of the account that here has been given, I'll read to you, and it'll be the last as we finish up the study today. As regard the Russian Sabbath observers, the so-called Sabotniki, we have to depend on account of their origin and present condition on a few extremely scanty notices. They belong to the Russian sect of Molokani, one of the various sects that arose during the 16th century in those provinces of southern Russia, which were at the time under the supremacy of the Polish crown. All of which sect displays a Judaizing tendency. Have you ever been asked if you were Jewish or a Jew? I mean, we are considered Judaizers because we have, in Christianity's eyes, blended Judaism, which is done away with, which means the law, with Christianity, which is the new covenant in their understanding. A marked leaning toward the Mosaic law. That's what Judaizing was described as. The Molokani, so runs the account, given by a Russian chronicler, observed the Sabbath and had their children circumcised. The performance of divine service and the execution of other religious practices they entrusted to the oldest and most learned men selected from their own body. Their worship consisted of reading the Bible and singing psalms. I mean, that's kind of what our worship consists of today, by a lot. We're heavily Bible invested in our teaching. And we have sung psalms for our hymns for many years. For the purpose of public worship, they assembled in a dwelling room they called the school. Now, I know that's a coincidence. It says it's a school or a skula, but I just think it's so funny that, you know, they met in a school. Well, whatever that meant. That was what they called the building. Persecuted in the government of Moscow, the Molkhan settled in that of Woronsek and subsequently spread throughout the neighboring government of Saratan. In the second half of the 18th century, the numbers of the first-named government had grown to 5,000 souls. By keeping their doctrine secret, they escaped persecution until they were betrayed in 1769 and made to suffer oppression by the state. Where in the world to this day do we find a body of Sabbath keepers? In the Ukraine. There has been for hundreds of years Sabbath keepers over there in that part of the country, and when Vic Kubik was gone over and others had begun to make contact, and they felt a kinship there, a brotherhood there. That doesn't mean we all started doing one thing, but they did not feel like they were Protestant. They obviously weren't Catholic, but they felt a kinship there, very strongly held. Andreas Ayosi lived in southeastern Europe. He was a rich man of noble birth who owned three villages and a great number of estates. He belonged to the earliest adherents of Unitarianism in Transylvania, Romania today. Having been visited by severe trials, he was ailing for many years. He lost his wife and three of his children to sickness. He sought consolation in religion. He read the Bible so long, runs an account from the chronicler mentioned, that he evolved there the Sabbatarian form of religion. What he recognized as truth, he endeavored to disseminate in the surrounding district. He composed treatises, prayers, and hymns, and he caused copies of these and other writings to be prepared, and he lent them out in all directions. He started to publish and produce and make manuscripts and send them out into the countryside. He was well versed in church history and was a complete master of the Old and New Testaments. From both he derived his teachings. Sometimes I've been asked by someone, well, what church do you go to? United Church of God. Well, how are you any different than anybody else? And when I say that, I said, well, you know, the Jews believe in the Old Testament and they don't put credence in the New. Many Christians have their doctrinal basis only in the New Testament, and they don't pay much attention to the Old. They look at the Old as simply historical. I said, we accept both the Old and the New Testaments as both history and as doctrine as well. And in my eye, that's our difference in a fundamental way. We Protestants use the New Testament. Jews, Protestants, Catholics, use the New Testament. Not totally exactly, but I'm talking about it for doctrine. The Jews use the Old, and we accept the whole Bible record, and our doctrines are on that basis. About 1600, there was compiled an old hymn book from Sabbatarians, probably composed by Ayosi himself. This book is the most important source from hence a knowledge of the doctrines of the sect may be derived. It's the oldest document of their literature and contains paraphrases of the Psalms and the poetical passages of the Bible, metrical renderings of the few extracts from the Jewish prayer book as well. Of the 110 poetical compositions which are to be found in these three manuscripts of the old Sabbatarian hymn book, there are no less than 44 Psalms which relate to the Sabbath, which on account of the special regard in which its celebration was held, gave the sect the name they bear. Interestingly, 5 psalms are about the new moon celebration, 11 psalms of the book are dedicated to the Passover, 6 psalms to the Feast of Weeks, 6 psalms to the Feast of Tabernacles, 3 to the Feast of Trumpets, which is the new year, and 1 to the Day of Atonement. Absolute direct reference to the holy days being kept as a body by a group of people very heavily invested in the Sabbath. Again, a remarkable chronicling. They did not celebrate Purim or Hanukkah, but even the Mosaic laws they did not observe in their entirety. They kept the dietary laws up to a certain limit. And then the account says, in all probability, they did not eat unclean meat, but did not keep kosher. In other words, they kept the dietary laws up to a certain limit. See, when a person looks at that, they look at the Jewish position. They did not keep circumcision at all. The Sabbath played the most important part in their religious life. It brought the contrast between them and Christianity most prominently into view. Isn't that amazing? Does it not do that to this day? Bring it most prominently into view? They called the Sabbath a celebration of spiritual marriage, and some adorned themselves in wedding attire. The Sabbath service consisted of prayers and hymns, introduced and concluded by a sermon or instruction. I just can't believe how consistent we've been. One of the sabbatical hymns mentions among the requests of proper observance of the Sabbath, study of the holy law, feed the poor, moderation in living, and cheerfulness of disposition. In another psalm it is said, let man first hallow himself, then the Sabbath of the Lord. In another psalm, although the feast of the first of Tishri is not designated the New Year festival in the Pentateuch, they celebrated it as the New Year with special emphasis as particularly characteristic. That they maintained that in adhering to these observances, they were following the example and teachings of Jesus, not the teachings of Moses. Who keeps not the Sabbath, they said, he who keeps not the Sabbath will have no portion in the inheritance of Christ, they celebrated. They celebrated the Passover over of Israel according to the command of our Christ. They bound up the Passover festival in accordance with the views which they entertained regarding the millennium. You know, the millennium is mentioned and addressed. The hope of the future redemption which Jesus will bring in order to build up his millennial kingdom. They understood the kingdom of God would be on the earth. I mean, it's enormous to see what they understood. They regard Jesus as greater than Moses, and the prophets call him our Christ, Lord Jesus, King, and even the Son of God. The last, however, in the sense that they all deserve to be called sons of God who are free from sin. For the most part, they reverence him as the Messiah, as the deliverer proclaimed by the prophets. On the other hand, however, they accentuate his purely human nature and laid stress on the belief that his mission had for its object not the destruction but the maintenance of the law. I could give a sermon right here. The Sabbatarians frequently declared that they joined themselves to Israel and they felt themselves to be Jews. We're spiritual Jews. That's the Bible record. In a Sabbath hymn occurs the following. We have chosen the observance of your law. We have found delight in the camp of Israel despite his miserable lot. We've chosen refuge in Israel, even though that's a terrible place to receive refuge in these times. In another song, not Abraham was our father, neither are we remnants of his seed. We are sprung from the house of Japheth, sons of ignorant heathens. Yet in you, our gracious Father, delight and exalt our heart, our soul, and our mouth. Though we were heathens, yet you have turned unto us and have made us sons of the great Abraham. Isn't it remarkable that they were in what is part of Russia today and considered them descendants of Japheth, and yet bonded into grafted into Israel. And again, it's a wonderful account. They declared the Christian festivals to be inventions of the popes. They protested against the ringing of church bells. They regarded the Lord's Supper not as a new institution of Jesus, but an old Jewish custom. On the first night of Passover, they ate unleavened bread, the bread of the Messiah, they called it, calling to mind the Redeemer who had appeared and who would one day come again. Very strong and wonderful account. From here, we'll move into England, and in England into the United States. And so I'll do that in the next study. I'm not sure if there's one study left with just that material or two. There may be a single study I'll have to